Hearing, the Supreme Court of the State of Idaho is now in session pursuant to law.
Are you seated, please? Good morning, I'm Dr. Supreme Court for a hearing on a pre-fall term on the hearing today involving an appeal by Schermeyer v. State of Idaho. This appeal is fought by Appellant Chad Schermeyer, and his counsel, Thomas R. Green, and Court, Your Honor. The respondent, State of Idaho, is represented by Ken Jones, making notes. Counsel, do you have any preliminary matters for the court?
No, Your Honor.
I would note that Justice Robin Billy has recused herself in this matter, and we have therefore ordered that Judge Robin, the Administrative District Judge of the 5th District, serve pro tem in this case. With that, Mr. Green, you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court. Big breath. I'm here representing Chad Schermeyer, a former deputy sheriff from Warren County, Idaho, who was convicted in 2017 for the alleged crime of grand theft. At the time, we thought he had several very interesting and powerful issues up for appeal. I even told him during closing argument states that we weren't going to win this trial and that we were going to have to take it to the Supreme Court to win the case. And I kind of saw him writing on the wall there, and that's what happened. But since that time, you know what we've been through, and we've now narrowed the issues down to three primary legal issues that I've set forth in the appellant's brief. Even when I did the motion for post-conviction relief, I had like six issues there, and we narrowed it down from there to three issues. And the reason I narrowed it down to those is because I believe those are ripe for the argument that if we win any one of those, it's a matter of the conviction being illegal as a matter of law, being not justified as a matter of law, even to the point of being a jurisdictional defect, in that the court would have lost jurisdiction to proceed to a conviction and sentencing on these three issues. So I thought they were definitely the most powerful issues. I like the fact that this court would only have to find one out of those three in order to reverse this case and remand it back to the district court for the hearing that it deserves. So before I get into the merits, we're well aware of the uphill battle now. It's one chance in, what, a couple of hundred of winning one of these where we're challenging, alleging insufficiency of counsel for failure to raise issues on appeal. There's only two or three cases where that's prevailed in Idaho, and I liked reading those cases to see what was really necessary to actually win one of those, and they're actually very encouraging with the facts of this case. I actually believe this is the best case you have ever seen so far in Idaho for the application of the principles that are applied in those cases, McKay and the Marsalis case. This is a better case than those two for the application of those principles. But before I get into the merits, I just wanted you to know that I understand the uphill battle we have. I understand all those principles of law. I didn't want to waste a lot of time on it. Basically, I have to prove to you, and you have to agree, that these, one at least, or all of these three elements are so strong, have such merit, that they would have virtually mandated a reversal of the district court and a remand. So, I know it's an uphill battle. Before I get into the merits of those issues, though, I'd like to discuss briefly the facts of the case. It's very interesting in appeals. I find it interesting these different standards of proof and how the facts are looked at. In your previous appeal at the time of the Chad Schermeyer case, you looked at the facts in the light most favorable to the state because of the issue involved. Now, you're going to look at the facts in the light right, most favorable to Chad Schumeyer because of the nature of this. But what I'm here to tell you is it doesn't make a bit of difference in this case. This case, like no other, it doesn't matter how you view the facts. They're just the facts. They're uncontested facts in this case. The facts are not contested by either side. They were all testified to by the state's witnesses, and they're just the facts. And neither party has raised any objection to any of the facts. I set forth in my brief on pages 9 through 14 of my opening brief the facts due in the light most favorable to Schumeyer in 11 numbered paragraphs. And so I do believe, and I appreciate that in the opinion you write, that you take these facts into consideration in the light most favorable to Schumeyer. The key facts, you've all already taken note of, and you've outlined them in your opinion, in the appeal already. Very important facts that Schumeyer was the manager of the corporation and all that it entailed, that he had the full powers of the board of directors through all the years that are alleged in this case, 6 years from 2009 through 2015, that all through that period of time, he was the only manager, he was the only officer directing the affairs of the corporation, and the powers that he had. He even put in the opinion that he did have the power to compensate the director of a program. Of course, he was the director of every program, so he had the power to compensate himself. Now, in your appellate decision, there are two places which I would like to call your attention, which I believe are incorrect. One is with respect to that power to compensate himself. And I think you misquote me. It's on the sixth page. I have the P3rd site. So it's on the sixth page of that. It's P3rd, page 901 site. And this is what you say. Finally, the defense argued that Schumeyer could compensate himself as the director of the program, yet explained that, quote, there's no evidence that he ever did that, but he had the right to do it. I did not say that. And that is, in the transcript, this is misquoting what I said. What I said in the transcript, it's in volume 2 of the transcript, page 1396. I did bring up the fact that he could determine what, if any, compensation shall be paid to the director of the project. And I said he's standing in the place of the board of directors, and he can also authorize himself a salary to be paid as a director of the corporation. There's no evidence that he ever did that, but he did have that right. He did have the right to do it. But that time I was talking about authorization, I did not say that he never compensated himself. In fact, the facts of this case are absolutely unchallengeable that he did compensate himself in the sense that he benefited himself, he took perks from the corporation, he outfitted himself completely with all kinds of equipment. The testimony in the case went to the fact that all those purchases of items that he purchased were items of outdoor equipment. All of them. And so I would like you to please correct that in any new opinion that you set forward.
And there's one other matter, I guess I better say this.
You did explain the state's theory of theft in this case, and that is found on page... So now we're on the P3rd side, page 900. Okay, this is what he said. At trial, both the state and the defense explained to the jury that Schumeyer had complete authorization to use the DIRPAL funds so long as his use was on behalf of and in furtherance of the program as limited by the articles of incorporation, the bylaws, and the program's official designation as a 501c3 corporation. That is false. I never said that. I
signatures were not in conformity with the articles of incorporation, would they be ultra-virus?
You're asking Justice Miller's question from the committee. That is, okay, they would not have been in, would they have been ultra-virus? They could have been challengeable as ultra-virus expenses, certainly. And so the question, the second question then followed along that line is, okay, who has the standing to raise that? And you know the answer to that. It's just the board of directors, and it's an inside corporate matter.
Well, I had my law clerk look at the model code upon which 303 or 304 is based. And the comments say that Section 304, however, does not validate corporate conduct that is made illegal or unlawful by statute or common law decision. This conduct is subject to whatever sanction, criminal or civil, is provided by statute or decision. And I think the comment that pertains to the statute that you're relying on suggests that your argument is flawed.
No, it doesn't, Your Honor, because that comment does not say, that does not create a cause of action. That does not create a viable theft theory. All that comment you just read me says is that does not provide any kind of a defense, if I'm not mistaken. That's the first time I've heard that. It's not providing a defense. If there's already out there a legitimate theft charge, that ultra-virus statute is not going to...
Mr. Schumacher from his behavior.
If he committed a legitimate theft crime under the statute, and that was legitimate, that ultra-virus statute would do nothing to clear him of that. However, that's not the case we have here. We have a case where the state invented a means theory of theft. That theory being that if expenditures are not in conformance with the articles of incorporation, then they're automatically a theft.
I don't think they're automatically, but they can be proven as theft, can't they?
No, because the ultra-virus statute gives you the deed as the standing. Well, I take that back. Perhaps they can. We don't have that situation here, but because the reason we don't is because the only way you're going to get there is somebody has to bring that to the court, somebody with standing. So, the district attorney's office does not have standing to bring that on its own without any contact from the board of directors whatsoever before filing charges. And I don't want to get into the part there. Would it be possible for the board of directors to contact the DA's office and file a complaint and then tiptoe into subsection C of the ultra-virus statute and get in that way? I don't want to discuss that because nobody contacted the board of directors, so we're not dealing with those facts. We're dealing with facts where nobody contacted the board of directors. They do not have standing to raise an ultra-virus issue.
But why is this ultra-virus? Ultra-virus is the corporation can't do what it's done. This is Mr. Schumacher, as you said, compensating himself. He's not acting as the corporation. He's acting in an individual capacity, and he's compensating himself. So I'm struggling with why are we talking about ultra-virus? Because we're not talking about corporate action. We're talking about Mr. Schumacher's action.
I'm not acting clean to say that, Your Honor, since he was the only officer running the affairs of the corporation at that time. There was no other officer running any of the affairs of the corporation. The corporation can only act through the actions of its officers and directors. He is the only one doing anything for the corporation.
But counsel, you've already admitted he was compensating himself. This was him compensating himself. This wasn't the corporation compensating itself.
I appreciate that comment very much. It gets me back on track. He was compensating himself because it had a contractual right to do so in the bylaws. So he was given that power to compensate himself. And it's undeniable. You can't argue with me about it. It's right there in the bylaws. He had the power to compensate himself, and he did. And you know he did. He took perks, he took benefits, he took all kinds of things. But one thing he did was...
Hold on a second.
Yes.
You keep switching back and forth between compensation and acting on behalf of the corporation. How was he acting on behalf of the corporation when he used the compensation to go hunting, to go fishing, to climb mountains? How was that part of his corporate duties?
I'm not saying it was.
You said he was acting on behalf of the corporation.
I'm saying that...
And he wasn't buying boy-sized shoes. He was buying adult-sized shoes that fit him. So how was he acting on behalf of the corporation when he used these items?
Okay, he was hired at a hotel where he was putting on the program over there at the top of the outdoor college. So he was fully equipped at that time when he left. He came, and so for the first 6 years, he was 7 years, he was operating from 2002 to 2000, up to end of 2008, under Sheriff Fenley. Was he entitled to equip himself from funds of the corporation, doing all of that numerous outdoor activities? Of course he was. And he did, throughout all that time as well. He could equip himself, but being fully equipped and doing all that is totally in line with the purposes of the corporation, especially when there's no oversight to even second guess it or judge it or comment about it or do anything, and he's the sole person in charge of the corporation. Do you believe they put in one person as the sole person in charge of a non-profit corporation, and yet that's authorized by statute, authorized by...
But you didn't argue it that way at trial. At trial, she says it was ultra-virus. And on appeal...
No, I didn't say it was
on a one error of the courts.
I'm sorry.
On appeal, the argument was made that this was all permissive, which was a change, which is why I asked the question that you mentioned before. The strategy on appeal appeared to be different than the strategy below, which was based on ultra-virus. On appeal, it was like, oh, this was appropriate actions taken on behalf of the company. So it just seems like you keep switching back and forth on your theory of the case here. You're losing me.
All right. I said I'm down to 9 minutes of my 25. So I'm going to cut right to the heart of the matter. I'm abandoning ultra-virus and I'm moving right on to the next two issues, which are the Henninger decision and the Bennett decision. So let's take Henninger first. That's a body of law that is well established in the Court of Appeals in Idaho, and it's continually cited. It was relied on and cited right up until, 2013, the Johnson case. And rely on that. And so the Henninger decision was initially acknowledged, the underlying basis for the Henninger decision was originally acknowledged in the Jerome case that was cited in Henninger. And so the Supreme Court signed off on that as well. And it's a valid body of law in Idaho. And it stands for the proposition that you cannot use the criminal law to enforce contractual obligations. And I set forth the law and the statute and the Idaho case, which says that bylaws are, in fact, contracts. I set forth the position that Mr. Schirmeier's total relationship with his nonprofit corporation was contractual. I don't think there's any argument about that. There has not been any argument contrary to that presented by the state, either below or now.
Was he an employee of the nonprofit?
No. He was just the manager. Not an employee, but he had the right to compensate himself as the director of public works. So he was not an employee in the sense that I think you mean that.
He was entitled to compensation, but he wasn't an employee.
That's correct.
It's an unusual relationship.
Well, it needs to be a contractual relationship. That you could be an officer and then have assignments to put on projects and be paid for that.
What's the contract that gave him that ability?
The bylaws. The bylaws are the contract by Idaho statute and by Idaho case law. It's a contract, and he would have the right, the contractual right under that to compensate himself, which he clearly did. So my only argument with regard to Henninger is simply this. It's a binding case law that's never been overruled or changed. It's been in existence for all these years. It applies to contract situations. This is a contractual situation. It's much less serious than the cases that I had at Henninger. Really, guy, look at the criminal, goes in and buys that truck, misrepresents the fact that his parents and his grandparents left him $5,000. He would bring that the next day, and then he went into the case. There's no about himself, that were available. The equipment itself, I mean, he bought like floor mats for his truck, because he's hauling his kids all around. That was a totally personal thing. I know his attitude was just by looking with him. It was, I'm not paying for a dime of things that affect my life through this program. The program was paying for everything that really affects me. But he only spent those excess funds. He did not leave the program of all his funds. He ran the program for 13 years within budget. So I've done the Henninger.
Let me ask you a question about Henninger. So in Henninger, the court said what happened didn't constitute theft by unauthorized control, but didn't the court also say Henninger could have been charged under a different theft theory?
Right.
So it doesn't stand for the premise that if there's a contract, you can't charge theft at all. It actually doesn't stand for the premise that the wrong theft theory was charged.
You're absolutely correct.
And so why does that apply here?
Because they didn't charge a different theory here. They charged no other theory other than that he violated the purposes provision of the corporation. Something, by the way, which, as you know by now, I'm sure, has never been raised. There's no reported case on that particular theft theory in the United States. Not just not in Idaho. There's no reported case that's holding that type of a theory of theft anywhere in the United States. I've been throwing down this gauntlet since doing trial, and nobody has ever produced a case. And I've maintained that. So I've maintained that challenge to everyone throughout the post-conviction relief proceedings. And also, he hasn't come up with any case. I'm pretty convinced now, with all the brains that have been looking on this, there is no case in the United States supporting that theory of theft.
Well, to the contrary, there's no case stating you can't charge this theory of theft in this circumstance. I didn't see you cite one in your brief. Was it in there?
Someone, Your Honor, would have to charge this theory of theft in order for there to be a case on it. No one's ever charged this theory of theft in the United States.
Let me rephrase my question. So I understand you to be saying this can't be charged in this circumstance, but I haven't seen you cite a case that involves similar facts that says this is a contract issue, this is not a criminal issue.
I haven't heard of proof, did I? I was told that I was going to sit and not say a word through the entire trial.
But now that you're on post-conviction relief, you do have a burden to show an effective assistance of counsel. And so part of that is, if the decision not to raise this theory was a strategic decision by appellate counsel, you have a heightened burden to show that this would have been a successful theory. And that's why I'm asking you, do you have a case to support your position that this would have caused Mr. Schermeyer to prevail?
There is no case, obviously. There is no case that says that a district attorney's office cannot use this theory of theft in prosecuting a theft charge. So I agree. But I want to move on now. I have got my 26 minutes. Let's get to the meat of this case, which is the Bennett decision. The Bennett decision now we're in some real strong area. It's not just a Bennett body of case law from the appellate courts. This is from the Supreme Court. We now have three cases in the Supreme Court upholding the principles in the Bennett case. What are those principles? First of all, the most important one really is that the time period, the time point where you have to make this decision, at what point must the previous owner, the previous possessor of the goods, at what point does it have to be determined that they have a superior right of possession right in the hand of the taker? And you have them done it very clearly that it's at the time of the taking. And then you also stated in there that it's upon the taking. You use that word. I especially appreciate that use of the word. I think it clarifies it even more. It means it's like instantaneous. It's upon the taking. At that moment is when that has to be determined. Well, in Bennett per se, the delivery was happened earlier, and then time passed, and he actually took the trailer at a later period of time, so we had a time expanse there. Senator Johnson, in the Johnson case, part of the Pulis case, that man delivered his funds for the purchase of the four motorcycles he was ordering earlier. He turned over the check. And then, at what time were those funds actually taken? We don't know, and it's not clear, but it was probably later, unless he actually had the time to take that money right there at that time, and yet that's when the taking occurred. We don't know. So it was probably a period of time before he took all that money.
So, Mr. Green, in the cases of Bennett and Dix, there was a transfer of property. The trailer and Bennett and Power Tools and Dix, and so the courts said that those are governed by the UCC.
You said that Article 2 of the UCC.
I said UCC. I didn't say Article 2 of the UCC. So there's a transfer of goods. There's not a transfer of money in those cases. So do you have authority other than Bennett and Dix and Henniger in which there was a transfer of money and the state was prohibited from prosecuting?
Johnson. The Johnson case is what I just told you about, the four motorcycles case from the belt, but the Johnson.
There were motorcycles involved in Johnson.
There were, the concept of motorcycles was involved. The motorcycles were never ordered, and they were never delivered. What was delivered was cash. The check was delivered, so that was a theft of funds in that case, and not a theft of motorcycles. And the UCC was brought up, UCC Article 3. The law concerning negotiable instruments. A negotiable instrument is an instrument that is given, and it was binding at the time it's given, and it means all possessory rights to those funds after it's given, unless there's some written restriction on it. So yes, I do have that. However, in this case, the Schumacher case, what I have is the UCC Article 4, Electronic Funds Transfer Law, which says that when you push the button and you do an electronic fund transfer, that is accomplished, and the transfer from one bank to another is accomplished at that moment, and it's to be judged under the law of electronic phone. in state law. And you're using it, that's...
I'm not as hard as I'm...
Thank you very much, I really appreciate it very much. Even though how much, we appreciate just being here.
Excuse me, may I please report? The ultraviolet issue having been abandoned, there is basically only one issue with a corollary, I suppose, with the jurisdictional question about the relationship of a contract to the theft charge. And so ultimately the claim is one of ineffective assistance of counsel. This is, quote, well aware that's a two-element claim, and it applies to appellate counsel as well as trial counsel. First off is the question of deficient performance, and second off is the question of prejudice. In relation to deficient performance, a strategic decision, which is what we have here, is very rarely, as I believe counsel acknowledged, overturned, because that strategic decision basically has to be proven to be objectively unreasonable on something that you can actually look at, some reason other than not just somebody else would have made a different decision, not even that this court would have made a different decision tactically. It has to be something objectively unreasonable, such as lack of preparation, ignorance of the law, ignorance of the facts, something along those lines. The claim here is ignorance of the law. We haven't seen any evidence of that. We haven't seen any evidence whatsoever that counsel was unaware of the applicable legal standards. She testified that she read the cases. She testified that she considered the issue, and she ultimately concluded it was not as good an issue as the one she raised. We have no deficient performance. And that's really carried out by the arguments in the brief before this court and the oral argument so far today. Just the fact that there is a contract between the victim and the defendant does not mean there can never be a crime, which seems to be the position taken here. The contract, in fact, in this case, had nothing to do with the crime. The contract was, you will do certain things on behalf of the corporation. What Mr. Schumacher did was certain things on behalf of himself. He enriched himself outside the boundaries of the contract. This isn't a mere contract dispute between Mr. Schumacher and the charity. The charity is the victim of theft. And that plays out in both the district court's decision and in looking at the facts of the case. All of the facts of the case is cited involved a commercial transaction between two parties, ultimately the one charged as the defendant and alleged to be the victim. In all of those cases, consideration flowed one way, and the return consideration did not come back. That's what this court has said is not a theft. If you have a contractual arrangement and you agree to do your half of the contract, you do it up front, then the other person doesn't do their half of the contract, that's not a theft. That's not at all what we have here. What we have is Mr. Schumacher just simply dipping into the account to buy himself things. So at the time of the theft, when he transferred that money from the charity bank account to a merchant in exchange for goods, he was taking funds that he was not entitled to. He had no contractual claim to those funds. And so that theory is just without merit there. And of course, appellate counsel rightly so concluded. That also addresses the prejudice problems. Ultimately, this theory would not have prevailed. Ultimately, Mr. Schiermeier's conduct does meet the statutory definition of theft. He was not the owner of the funds at the time he took them and used them for his own advantage, and therefore his counsel on appeal was not ineffective for failing to raise that theory. And therefore the state would request that this court affirm the district court order dismissing the post-conviction relief petition. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there any questions? The Baptist stands under advisement.